celebrate the feast day of St. Francis by having a pet blessing. People will bring dogs and cats and other animals. One year, a kid wearing these heavy fireplace gloves brought a hedgehog. Not kidding. He got an air blessing. It's a way to celebrate the love that we get from God, even from animals. And we invite the local shelter to come and bring some of their dogs. They get all spiffed up and put on these bandanas, hoping to be adopted. I have a special soft place in my heart for dogs that need adopting. My wife has had to watch me very closely the last few years that I don't bring home a new dog from the pet blessing. And that commercial they used to run, I don't know if you ever saw it, showed these dogs and cats in cages while Sarah McLachlan sang that song about the arms of an angel, and the narrator talked about abused and neglected pets. It would just bring a lump to my throat. Just got me every time. And why not? Dogs are by nature loving creatures. They want to love and be loved, and unless they are abused or conditioned or trained out of it, they crave human contact. And even those, some of those who have been trained otherwise can be rehabilitated. I read where one of Michael Vick's fighting dogs later became a therapy dog at the hospital, bringing comfort to patients and taking their minds off their sufferings. And so a lot of people are like I am. They are sympathetic toward dogs, stray dogs. If they see one, they might be cautious at first, make sure the dog is not aggressive, but then talk sweetly to it, maybe even pet it. If it's hungry, they might put out some food and water, and if it's sick or hurt, they might try to seek help for it. It just seems natural. But if it is so natural, why don't we show the same compassion for stray humans? Because, you know, most of us, when we see a fellow human who looks disconnected and homeless and uncared for and unkempt, well, rather than react with compassion, we turn away, we try not to make eye contact, we try to keep our distance. We react with fear. Not fear that they're going to hurt us, especially if there's other people around, fear that they're going to pester us or bother us or make us feel uncomfortable. And to justify our actions, we make these sweeping generalizations about them. Oh, they're all addicted to drugs. Oh, they're all criminals. They're out to defraud us and take our money. They're all crazy. And so we don't even look at them, let alone associate with them. I know I'm guilty of that. Shame on me. But that's not how the kingdom is supposed to work. Because the truth is, as Christians, we believe that unless they are trained or conditioned out of it, human beings were created to love and be loved. We are supposed to be connected. We are supposed to be in community. Even people who claim they want to be alone really need human contact. Way back in Genesis 2, God said, "It is not good for the human being to be alone." We need companionship. And that's really what Jesus' parable today is all about. He talks about a poor man named Lazarus. Well, that's sneaky and significant for two reasons. First of all, this is the only occasion where a character in one of Jesus' parables gets a name. The only one. So Jesus is implying this is not an object. This is a person with a name, a person with a personality. But second, it is the name that he chose, because that name appears only one other time in the New Testament, and that's to name Jesus' close friend, the brother of Mary and Martha, whose house Jesus went to whenever he needed to rest and relax. You know, Lazarus was the one that Jesus even brought back from the dead to live a little longer. And so Jesus may be implying here, this is not just any person. This is one of my close friends. Well, there's another character in the story. He's not important enough to get a name, but he thinks of himself important. Every meal he eats is a sumptuous feast. He dresses in purple, you know, like bishops, just saying. You know. He surrounds himself with luxury and comfort. And even though Lazarus lays at his gate, a gate which is the opening to get through the barriers with which the rich man has surrounded himself to allow those who want to have company with the rich man to enter, Lazarus is not allowed to enter. Lazarus is not allowed to have company with him. In fact, even though Lazarus is lying there every day, there's no indication that the rich man gives him any consideration at all. Lazarus longs to eat even the table scraps that might fall from the man's table. But nobody gives him any comfort except, well, wouldn't you know it, the dogs. Well, Jesus says they both die, they both go in the afterlife, but their circumstances are completely different. Lazarus is now living in comfort, comfort with the great ancestor, Father Abraham. The rich man is in agony. And he's begging for mercy, but he can't get any mercy because there's this great chasm, this great barrier that separates him from Lazarus and Abraham. And you have to wonder if this isn't the fulfillment of the rich man's wish, after all. All his life, he's wished to keep Lazarus and people like him away from him, and now he's got his wish. He has fixed this chasm by his own desires. Isn't it funny how in the New Testament, whenever somebody draws a line or a fence or a wall or a barrier to keep people out, we usually find Jesus, or in this case Abraham, on the other side of the line with the outcasts. I don't think Jesus is saying that the rich man is being punished just for being rich. Sounds like it, especially when we couple it with that 1 Timothy reading about money being a root of all kinds of evil. But if we look at the context that this parable is told, we get a different idea. You see, the context, if we back up a chapter or so, is that Jesus has just been accosted by the Pharisees for hanging out with the wrong sort of people. He's hanging out with prostitutes and tax collectors and poor people. And so Jesus starts telling these stories. He tells a story about a lost sheep. He tells a story about a prodigal son. And he emphasizes that older brother in that story. You know, the one who refuses to restore community with his younger brother, even though his younger brother has repented. And then he tells this story about a rich man who refuses to even establish community with Lazarus, because Lazarus is poor. And the rich man had resources to help him, but refused to do anything about it. I believe Jesus is saying, we need to be connected, and that no one needs to be beneath our contempt. We don't need to be building these chasms, these barriers. Our church has a ministry that gives money to people to help with their utility bills. After Katrina, we had a number of people come to Tuscaloosa looking for help, and so they assigned various needs to various churches, and ours got utility bills, and we're still doing that. But there's so many people who need help and so few resources that we can only give a little bit to each person. It barely makes a dent. And yet every week, people come from miles around and they stand in line for a long time just to get that little bit of help. And one of the volunteers told me, it's not just the money. It's the fact that here they know that someone will sit with them and listen to their story, sympathize with them, pray with them if that's what they want, and respect their dignity. Not accidentally, that ministry is called the Lazarus Ministry. and probably your church has ministries too, but this sermon is not about those ministries. It's about our attitude towards people, and not just poor people, but all people. This morning, I had the great honor of baptizing my grandson right here in All Saints. And we celebrated the fact that my grandson is a child of God. The baptism didn't make him a child of God. The baptism just helped the community and the family celebrate and recognize that he's a child of God so that he can then live into it. And the way he is going to live into it, we hope, is by keeping that baptismal covenant that we all stood up and joined together to say, that pledge allegiance to God, that plan for Christian action, that vow we make to live differently as Christians. And the last promise we make in that baptismal covenant is that we will respect the dignity of every human being. And that means rich humans and poor humans and attractive humans and unattractive humans. I get that some people are dangerous, that some people are trying to take things from us. We have to be cautious at first, like we are with stray dogs. I understand that sometimes when we give financial help to others, they might use it in some destructive way, like to further some addiction, although that never seemed to bother C.S. Lewis. My daughter told me a story that one time he was walking down the road with his editor, Walter Hooper, and a beggar came up, and C.S. Lewis gave him some money, and Walter said, "What are you doing? You know, he's only going to take that money to the local pub and get drunk." And C.S. Lewis said, "Great, that's what I was going to do with it." I recognize that poverty does not make people more noble or deserving, but our wealth doesn't make us any more noble or deserving either. And so we need to be in community and stay with community with our family members, our neighbors, our coworkers, strangers, people that cut us off in traffic, people that support the wrong politician, people that support the wrong football team. We are supposed to be ministers of reconciliation, which means instead of seeing all those people as competitors in this game of life that we're supposed to beat out, they are people that we are supposed to reach out to and establish community and at least respect one another. Because who knows? The next person we meet might just be our Lord's very close friend.